Coming up on Boston Public Radio, the Globe's Frank Phillips and Herald's Peter Galzinis join us to talk politics, the travails of Deval Patrick, the state of the state GOP, the coming of casinos, and the near deal on gays marching in the St. Patrick's Day parade. Then we'll ask you, is the controversy over the parade much ado about not much, or is it a major moment for Boston?
We're all revved up with the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. You know the fear and loathing over a Wellesley College sculpture of a sleepwalker in his underpants? Well, what if that sleepwalking man were black? Then Jared Bowen on the best and worst of last night's Oscars, from weird jokes to moving and not so moving acceptance speeches. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Why do you have a smile? What
I'm
do you
waiting
think?
For you to say my name.
Hi, Marjorie. How are you? I never say Marjorie, and people call every day and email every day.
I've had about 20 people say, would you tell them to stop calling you Marjorie? So please cease and desist.
I've never done it. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. So March is coming in like a rabid wild lion, and the State House things are equally turbulent, from the rocky rollout of the medical marijuana dispensaries to the dysfunctional health connector to troubles at the top of the Department of Children and Families. Oh, and by the way, there's that parade in 2 weeks. Here with us in Studio 3 to go over these and other political headlines are Boston Herald columnist Peter Galzinis and former Boston Herald employee, now head of the State House Bureau at the Boston Globe. That'd be Frank Phillips. Frank, Peter, good to see you both.
Best years of my life working for Rupert Murdoch.
That's right. It was great.
It's been downhill. It's been downhill for Frank ever since.
I loved it.
Who had the best bar? Was it the Boston Herald's bar?
No. I thought you meant the Herald.
The Globe doesn't have a bar. The Herald had the bar. J.J. Foley's in the South End, right?
There were bars inside the place.
Listen to this. The most animated Frank has ever been.
It was great.
You know what I loved? All you said, sources said.
Someone
asked you who it was.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in the old days,
right.
You know,
it was good enough.
You get down to cash your paycheck down there by J.J. Foley's. You were taking your life in your hands. You once had to die for the sidewalk. Didn't we, Peter Galzinis?
Now it's
evading the gunshots.
Now it's SOWA.
Yeah, now it's SOWA. That's right.
It's a beautiful place.
So anyway, you just heard Jim list this litany of disasters that are befalling the Patrick administration, this terrible death of this young man, Joshua Messier, down at Bridgewater State Hospital, the health connector. We may have to just tear it up and start all over again. Marijuana, the Department of Children's Services, everything. And yet, Deval Patrick had been like in Costa Rica for most of last week. Now, I don't know. Maybe I missed it. But usually we'd have this, what is he doing on vacation? Why isn't he here handling the state, Frank Phillips? Did I miss that in the Boston Globe?
No, you've seen it in a number of places. We've written it. And he got in at 1 o'clock this morning. So I don't, you know, he was operating out of Costa Rica on those issues. But I must say, if I were a Democratic candidate for governor, I would be very concerned about what Deval Patrick has to pick it up in the next between now and November and get back in charge, because I think the voters are going to get a little agitated about his all the things that are coming down, and you gave a litany of them, and it looks like things are just out of control on the state level, and it's not good for the Democrats.
Yeah, he does look a little bit disengaged, wouldn't you say, Peter Galzinis?
You know, I think that, you know, all of these things that he was talking about seem very progressive in some respects, you know, the marijuana dispensaries.
Well, he opposed
and the health
that. Let's be clear. He opposed the I shouldn't. He has never said outright that he opposed it, but it's pretty clear he's not crazy about it. Let's put it
right.
That way.
But still, I mean, I think the idea of, you know, it's like the details. It's like the follow through. You know, how can, you know, I would have assumed I'm as big a, you know, high-tech Luddite as you can get. But, you know, I would have thought that given our situation with RomneyCare early on that, you know, that we wouldn't have run into these kinds of problems. It's almost like, you know, it's like putting your shoes on and then deciding, well, you know, I better get my pants on now, you know, and not being able to do that. I mean, I don't understand how that wasn't those technical glitches on the health connector weren't taken care of long ago.
But the other problems we're talking about, including the fact that he disciplined and reprimanded some people at the Department of Correction over the death of this
right.
guy at Bridgewater
Joshua
State,
Messier.
What, in 2009, those aren't technological things. Those
are managerial those are details.
Issues.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm not a great political historian. Maybe, Frank, you and Peter probably both are. This is, we haven't seen these kind of, until we saw the thing with the drug labs, which I don't think the problem can be laid at the doorstep of Deval Patrick. The question is, how does he address it? This is fairly new after 7 years of this guy, isn't it?
It's, I think what we're talking about here is not so much that they're problems and they're crisis and things are not working well. It's his attitude towards it. And we see it in the press. He gets a little snippy and he's tried to downplay it. And I think what he did this last week, I think somebody really got to him and said, look, you got to do something dramatic, even from Costa Rica, from the jungles
of
Costa Rica. You
got
to phone in some orders here and get this, make a quick move and appear engaged. And,
right.
and you know, on the DCF thing, the child welfare issues, he was sort of just, oh, just take it easy. You're pushing it too hard. And he was... It didn't go over well, I know, in the media, and I think it was getting out around among the electorate and the people of Massachusetts not feeling very good about the way his attitude was.
I'm sorry, Peter.
No, Marjorie and I have spoken for years about the idea of, you know, what a thankless job running the DCF or being in that position is, and how it's, you know, sucked some very talented people into the vortex. But, you know, the thing is, you know, he has to. He can't take that. I mean, it's one thing for the two of us to talk about that in the abstract and what a difficult, thankless situation it is. But, you know, his sort of nonchalance about Roche, I think, sort of suggests the same thing.
The Commissioner of DCF, yeah.
You know, it suggests, look, this is almost a thankless, hopeless task. She's trying her best. We should understand that. He can't afford to say that. He can't afford to take that. He's got to get in there like a mechanic and pull that apart and try to put it back together as best he can. I mean, sometimes I think when he sort of shrugs this stuff off, as Frank was saying, you know, he's not in a position to do that.
Do you think that part of it, though, Frank, you say, Peter, you just used the term shrugging it off. Is it in part a calculation that most of these things don't matter to people? If he was raising taxes, they know everybody cares. But we've had this discussion a lot in here. How much, sadly, do people really care about poor kids? How much do people care about the marijuana dispensaries? And while it seems to, I mean, why are you making a face at me? You think
I think you're right. No. I think people, if it was raising taxes, like in the late 80s, when you were out there in front of the State House demanding we all raise taxes.
That's right.
Demanding fairness.
I remember
fairness.
That very clearly.
You love
fairness.
Taxes.
Yeah.
Fairness,
taxes.
Yeah.
And people were losing their jobs and people were being laid off. There's anger about that. I think, you know, people look at, the DCF, again, their child welfare issues and the drug labs. These are problems. And I don't think it's really chipped into his popularity to a great extent. I think maybe he's down a little. But the economy's doing well. People aren't facing foreclosures. There's not a lot of anger out there.
How's his staff? You know, Marjorie and I were talking this morning. He started with some staff people 7 years ago that were not ready for prime time, and he got rid of them pretty quickly. I don't even know. How is his staff 7 years in? Do you know? You probably don't want to say. Is that a fair statement?
Wait.
I want to hear. He has a smile that suggests to me. I'd like to hear a response.
No, I want to ask you a question about your
Frank
staff.
Frank is trying to make, he's figuring out, can I make a joke about Jim so I don't have to answer this question? Go ahead, Frank. How is the staff and
how's your diet going?
It's actually going quite well. You don't want to answer that question? It's fine.
I'll answer the question. It's always difficult particularly in the last several years in a lame duck administration. You're not going to get the best talent, most experienced talent all around. There's not the energy, and the governor doesn't have the energy. He's looking at his legacy. He's looking at, what am I going to do next year? You hear all kinds of reports that every time he meets with business groups, he talks about, what's interesting for me to do, you know? He's looking beyond this, and I think that reflects in the staff. He's still, you know, the cabinet is still pretty much there, and I think people are functioning, but it's not the high-caliber energy that you go when you first come in and you fall and you slip and you get yourself going, and he got himself reelected, And I think in the first year or two, you know, he did the casinos. He did a highway transportation bill that got kind of cut up. But, you know, he's done some things.
Well, he did pension reform. And he did pension the reform, second round of education reform and ethics.
He did some things. And now it's his last year. And I think he's got one foot out the door.
How'd you react when your colleague and best friend, Scott Lehigh from the Boston Globe, described him as Mr. Magoo in his in his column about 2 weeks ago? What's your answer to that one?
I think
that was a bit much?
No, it's a good pushback to the governor. And in his, I think there is an analysis there, and that he is sort of like, you know, he's not reacting well to what's going on around him and taking the leadership that he should.
Well, you know, you're right, though. A lot of these things, DCF, obviously poor kids, no constituency there. This Joshua Messier that was killed at Bridgewater State Hospital suffering from mental illness.
Mike Resendez had not written the piece in the Globe, this wouldn't have happened at all.
We would never have known about it.
But very fine piece by Mike.
Yes, it was a great piece. But it's a certain subset of people. It's not like everybody. The health connector, again, mostly people that don't have their own insurance. So it is sort of a certain segregated group of people. But in some ways you think that should be even more upsetting because there are people with no power. And the fact that I think if you are a poor, struggling mother now who's got drug problems or mental health problems or something and your kid is going to be taken away from you, you have no sense your kid's going to be in a better place. But you know what I'm saying? It's really upsetting.
It's the chattering class more than it is the rumble below. The people are really upset. And it's taxes, and raising, you know, not cutting the budget and getting all stirred up by right-wing, you know, talk show hosts.
Yeah.
Well, and the idea, too, is that, you know, it's stirring the waters because they think he's vulnerable. And like you said, it's going to rub off on the Democratic candidates to come.
None of whom, I'm trying to think, as Frank said that a while ago, Peter, I'm trying to think, other than Martha Coakley being the second leading Democrat to say they should dump the whole medical marijuana dispensary selection process and start all over again, the first being Bob DeLeo, the Speaker of the House, I can't think of one major candidate of the five Democrats who have criticized Deval Patrick on anything. Deval Patrick is still the darling of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party who are going to the convention in June. That's a pretty scary thing to be doing.
You go out to these, sessions where the Democratic candidates appear before, you know, these activist voters.
We call them caucuses, by the way.
Talking about before even the caucus, okay?
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Jesus. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, go right
anyway. You know, candidates' nights, and they're all channeling Deval Patrick, and they're talking. You know, as the governor has done so well, I'm going to build on that, on education, on transportation, on the environment. They almost to the T, every one of them channels Deval Patrick because this is a constituency, and this is going to be a problem for the Democrats. Is that once they get the nomination, they're going to have to dial it back a little on the left because they appeal to the left, and you're going to be facing this moderate Charlie Baker. And it's going to be
a kinder, gentler Charlie Baker this time.
Right, that's right. Not only as angry
supposedly.
Charlie.
You know,
Charlie Baker.
Before we get to Baker, and we do want to talk about Baker's candidacy in a second, it seems to me, as we're talking about what caused this sort of managerial crisis atop a number of departments in Deval Patrick's government, I'd say part of it, Peter Galzinis, is an absence of Republicans on Beacon Hill. When there is no, I mean, what are there now? Four? How many senators are there? Four. Republican senators, I think. 30-some Republican House, which is virtually nothing. And it doesn't really matter. I don't mean this disrespectfully to those 35 people or 36, but it really doesn't matter what they say about anything. Isn't that potentially part of the problem? When there is, the only opposition you have is when Bob DeLeo stands up and says, I'm not going to do a candy and cigarette tax that you want.
Right.
I know it doesn't keep you on your toes in the same way it would if there was a serious opposition party, right? Which there hasn't been in ages.
No, and I think the state is, you know, generally left of center. You know, he knows that. I think you don't have, I mean, other than, as Frank was saying, other than the chatter you're going to get on certain radio stations against him, or in certain publications, you're not going to, you don't have that.
You know, by the way, you just smiled and looked at Marjorie as if it's the Herald. Joan Vinaki, liberal columnist for the Globe,
it's true. No,
and
it's
Scott
true,
Lehigh savaged him 2 days in a row. So it's not just a right-wing cabal anymore.
No,
you know?
No.
That's true.
No.
It's gone beyond that. You know, we didn't mention this before the show, Jim, but may I introduce a different topic that we forgot to mention?
You may do whatever you want.
The whole probation department case, as people know, John O'Brien, this was a Globe story, I must admit, is now facing federal charges because of rigging the hiring in the probation department. But since he's been removed from his job and is now getting, you know, ready to face his trial, we've seen this laundry list of everybody from Martha Coakley to, you know, Scott Harshbarger, viewed as kind of Mr. Clean by lots of people, to Scott Brown, like an across-the-board smorgasbord of politicians who've also written these recommendations of people that helped them in their campaigns or gave them money for jobs in the probation department. So isn't this kind of going to dilute? I mean, isn't the jury going to get up there and say, well, okay, maybe he did rig the system, but look at all the other politicians that were trying to get their friends in there. Doesn't this hurt his case?
I think they have to make the distinction between, I mean, patronage is something that they're all, you know, it sticks to all their shoes. I mean, you know, Paul Ware, the guy that did the independent report, you know, there's a situation in the files where, you know, he helped get his sister a job in the federal probation years ago.
That's right. I forgot
about that. And so this is going to come up. This is going to be the thing. You know, who are you to point at us? The question they have to do is draw that distinction between the umbrella, the universe of patronage, and this sort of, you know, qualitative framework they set up, which supposedly they're saying, you know, O'Brien deliberately ran around and sort of rigged up the situation. In other words, there was this qualitative process in place to judge people, and he just ignored it. But patronage is, you know, that's why it is going to be difficult, I think, for citizens in a jury box, unless they can make that distinction, unless the government is very, very skilled in making that distinction, because they're just going to, you know, Saylor, the judge, is fighting a pretty spirited attempt to remove him from the bench on this kind of situation.
I thought you were going to say it's going to be pretty hard to put a jury together who doesn't have a relative who's in the probation department.
No, exactly.
What are you going to say there, Frank?
I agree with Peter. I mean, who else do you go to if you want a job in the government? You go to your state rep.
Right.
That's a long – and there's nothing wrong
but
with
what's
that.
What's wrong? Exactly.
There's nothing wrong.
Right.
What is wrong is that what went on between the and Finneran, Tom Finneran, who was a great speaker in many ways, but also had his own ways of doing things, was set up O'Brien to took him out of the from under the judiciary, and they provided him with the budget, and they doubled the budget for the probation department, and set up a whole patronage system using the budget system. There were allegations. I don't think DeLeo was ever involved in it, and I don't think anybody's been able to prove it.
He was Ways and Means Chair at that point,
He was Ways and Means Chair, and he needed, when Finneran was leaving, or DeMasi was leaving, was to become the next speaker, that he was using the probation jobs to get, you know, that and funding the budget to do that. I think some people around DeLeo were talking that way, and it got around that this is actually what happened. That's where the corruption is, not because some Joe Bloke out in Medford went to Paul Donato and said, "Jesus, can you help me get my job in the district court?"
So the distinction is going to be able to be made clear. You're not worried about this diluting.
Well, I think it's up to the prosecution to make that distinction clear, that this is just not about jobs; it's about a quid pro quo.
Jim and I always try to remember the name of the guy that was that had two jobs and he called into one sick for like 120 days.
Oh, that Steve Bailey wrote about.
Other, and the guy went to trial for holding down two jobs and collecting two pensions and calling in sick for all those days. And the jury said, "Hey, this goes on all over the place in Massachusetts. We're just going to acquit him." It was unbelievable. And I think he got the two pensions and the two health cares and everything else.
In any case, we've got to take a brief break.
I will.
I'll look it up during the break.
Get on top of that.
Frank Phillips and Peter Galzinis are not going away.
No, we're going to come back and we're going to talk about casinos. We're going to talk about the state of the GOP and a couple more things with Peter and with Frank as soon as we return.
Thank you. We don't really feel safe sleeping someplace that a stranger has been in.
What's the reason behind the recent surge in home break-ins? We put that question to Belmont's assistant chief of police.
The items that are taken, the quick conversion to cash, that is really what is driving these kinds of trends throughout the state, is people with the need for opiates or heroin.
I'm senior investigative reporter Philip Martin with a look into some of the ripple effects of the heroin crisis this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Christoph von Dohnányi and Yefim Bronfman join forces for all Beethoven programs, March 13th through 22nd. More information at bso.org. And Savers Thrift Stores, accepting donations of gently used clothing, furniture, and household items, and helping local nonprofits raise funds. Details at savers.com.
Hi, it's Christopher Kimball from America's Test Kitchen. Lots of cultures have their very own way of giving thanks for food, rituals and words that mean something very special. And hearing my compliments to the chef always warmed my heart. Well, 89.7 is on a mission to say thank you to 3,000 WGBH supporters. And when you add your name to that list by making a gift in any amount, you'll be automatically entered to win two tickets to a taping of America's Test Kitchen TV show at our Test Kitchen in Brookline. Also, a copy of our cooking school cookbook signed by the entire cast, and subscriptions to both of our magazines, Cooks Illustrated as well as Cooks Country. To do your part and be entered into the contest, call 888-897-9424 or go to our website, wgbhnews.org. Thanks and good luck.
That's right. You call 888-897-9424 or pitch in online at wgbhnews.org. You're listening to WGBH at a very important time. It's the first and only Monday of our March community campaign, and there's a bunch of special reasons why right now is the best time to give. Joining us in Studio 3 is...
Edgar B. Herwick III.
That is true. And, you know, one of those important reasons is basically the whole idea of this campaign is that we want to say thank you. If you saw the Oscars last night, the Oscars is one of the great thanking platforms of our time,
sure,
right?
It's
just people thanking people left and right. But we want to thank you. And the goal of this very short campaign is to thank 3,000 people before it's all said and done. And we want to thank you. And we're going to thank you if you make a contribution to keep Boston Public Radio on the air. That's the idea here. We love Jim. We love Marjorie. We want to keep them here on the air. And when you make a gift in any amount, that's what you're doing. And then what we're going to do is we're going to say thank you. It's pretty simple. And that's what we want to do. Here's how you get involved right now, 888-897-9424. That's the number. Let me give it to you one more time, a little bit more slowly. 888-897-9424. Or if you're listening online right now at wgbhnews.org, just a couple of clicks and you can be a contributor right now.
Before you send that email, by the way, I know you're going to respond to what Edgar just said about you loving Jim and Marjorie. We know that's half true. So you can just leave it at that. Now, if you're hungry for an incentive to do some good, how about a year's worth of goodies from America's Test Kitchen? Keep New England's plate full of the good stuff by supporting WGBH and America's Test Kitchen. We'll say thanks with, listen to this, annual subscriptions to their magazine Cooks Illustrated and Cooks Country, plus a copy of their latest cookbook. It's called Cooking School, signed by the entire cast, and two VIP invitations to the Test Kitchen in Brookline for a special taping of the show. How do you do that? You call 888-897-9424 or get in on this contest by doing your part online at wgbhnews.org.
Now, we know that on-air fundraising is probably not your favorite part of WGBH, but there's a really easy way to get less of this and more of the programs you love. You sign on as a sustainer. It's really easy. You break down your gift into monthly installments that automatically renew, and that automatic renewal helps us plan better, and better plans mean fewer fundraisers. 888-897-9424 is the number, or become a sustainer online at wgbhnews.org.
You know, and if you become a sustainer today only, we have a very special thank you. In addition to just wanting to say thank you on the air, we can thank you with a pretty cool gift, which is two passes to the Peabody Essex Museum. Jim, Marjorie, you guys been there?
Marjorie was there last weekend for the first time.
And I was
so good, right?
Fixed. It was fantastic.
It.
The birds dancing on the guitars are still there.
Yeah. So their general collections, their collection is
fantastic.
Unbelievable. I mean, they have maritime art, Indian art, American art, Asian.
Great,
I mean,
for kids.
It's such a good museum. And so we can thank you if you become a sustainer at any level. So as Marjorie was just saying, that's when you break down your gift into monthly installments that automatically renew. You pick the price. So It's not, we're not giving you bills. It's like five, you could do $5 a month, you could do $10 a month, you could do $13.74 a month, whatever you want. But if you do that today, and this is today only, we're going to thank you with not just two passes to the Peabody Essex Museum, but also the brand new 89.7 Eco Tote. So if you ever use a bag, I mean, I don't know if you use bags in your life, but this is a nice sturdy bag with a flat bottom. It's got the WGBH logo emblazoned on it. Yeah,
like
very,
that.
Very sharp, very handsome. You look very handsome with it.
Oh, good.
Handsome with the bag. So 888-897-9424. Like I said, this is the only day, it's really the only couple hours now. If you want to support Jim and Marjorie, you want to support Boston Public Radio, and you want to get your hand on two passes to the Peabody Essex Museum and an Eco Tote, make that call right now at 888-897-9424 or give online at WGBHnews.org.
So however you can help, we promise it'll make a huge difference. Your support is what keeps you and your entire community connected to in-depth news and unique storytelling, not to mention Jim and Marjorie. Call 888-897-9424 or just give online at WGBHnews.org.
There's this place right here in New England where time travel is real, where you can explore ancient civilizations, meet 18th century Chinese merchants, even dance with dragons and sail the seven seas, all without leaving the North Shore. Today only, become a WGBH sustainer, and the Peabody Essex Museum will say thanks with two passes for free admission. And to help you pack for the adventure, 89.7 will toss in our brand new WGBH Eco Tote. Call 888-897-9424 or become a sustainer online at WGBHnews.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Brady. She is not Marguerite Egan. She is Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're going over the latest political news with Boston Herald columnist Peter Galzinis. Hey, Peter. And
hi,
Frank
Jim.
Phillips. He's the State House Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. My apologies.
Thanks,
Frank.
Jim Brown.
Well, you want to get to your question that you're obsessed with, why there are so few Republicans?
By my count, I may be off by one. Let me start with you, Frank Phillips. There are 15 either congressional seats, 9 House, 1 Senate, and 5. There are 5 constitutional officers other than Lieutenant Governor.
Did you say 15 congressional seats?
No, 15 seats altogether that are open this November, either constitutional officers statewide or congressional seats. By my count, the only major Republicans announced for any of these seats, Richard Tesei is running against John Tierney again on the North Shore. And obviously, Charlie Baker is running again for governor. Is this now the Republican convention is in what, 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks? Is that all there is, as Peggy Lee said? Is that all they can do?
It is all there is. There was a lot of bravado and beating the chest last summer where Bill Weld and all the other poobahs from the party got together and said, we're going to put out a slate and get a slate. And all of a sudden, Scott Brown's moving into Hampshire. He's not going to run against Markey. So they got some little-known selectman from Hopkinton running against Markey, who's up again in November for Senate. And they don't have anybody. They don't have anybody on the for the candidate for the Attorney General. They've got a city councilor from Medford who's trying to challenge Bill Galvin, who's overwhelmed.
Secretary of State.
I don't think they have anybody for auditor, and they got somebody for treasurer, a wealthy businessman, but he's never run before, running for treasurer. That's the two they should have had somebody, the open seats they have a shot at. They had somebody good for Attorney General, because that's going to be an open seat, and the
treasurer's office
is an open seat.
They should be going for that. Because Grossman and Coakley are both running.
And they really have fallen down flat on their faces.
See, here's my theory. I asked Charlie Baker this question a few weeks ago, and I can't remember what his answer was. I think this is bad for balanced two-party government and good for Charlie Baker. It seems to me the more Charlie Baker is virtually the only man standing, assuming he's the nominee, which one assumes he's going to be, the nominating convention is on March 22nd in 3 weeks, and one is able to say this is essentially the only balance you can bring to Massachusetts. Maybe Richard Tesei beats John Tierney, but that's a congressional thing. I think it helps Charlie Baker that essentially there's no there other than him. You don't agree with me, do you?
No. I defer to my my colleague here in terms of his expertise, but I was thinking that I was telling Marjorie that I think that sooner or later I'll be sitting down with Charlie, but But, you know, there are Republicans I've liked and one or two that I've voted for, I'll admit, as a card-carrying moonbat. But partly because, you know, one of the guys that I go back thinking was sort of the salt of the earth type was Frank Sargent. You know, and sometimes I think that you know, the notion of what the, you know, the kind of strange permutations of the National Republican Party that go on there, this what Rand Paul is trying to do now, and you see some of this sort of figuring out how do we get it together. You know, in Massachusetts, I think Brown was probably the closest to that, this idea of a different kind of Massachusetts Republican.
Wait, Charlie Baker's not that?
He's No. I'm saying a different kind, but I'm saying Baker in some. From my point of view, and it's just me, I mean, when I look at Baker, I see a lot of similarities, at least to Sargent, in the sense that I see a guy, or like Weld was the same way, somebody that you felt, even as a Democrat, was approachable, somebody you could happily live with. You know, I didn't see that with Brown. I haven't seen it with some of the others.
The other thing is their U.S. Senate nominee who beat the establishment. This guy came from nowhere. Gabriel Gomez.
Right.
A Latino. Looked like the future of the party.
Former military guy.
That's all he could talk about, apparently. Right. That's why he's eventually lost. He wasn't that good. But he ran one time. He looked good. He gave Markey a good run. And he just walked away from it. A little erratic behavior is going out for that independent. At one point, it looked like he was endorsing McCormick, the independent. Now he's back in the Republican fold. But where is he? Why didn't they get him out there to run for treasurer?
I've asked him the same questions. I assume you have, too. But it really is a sparse field. See, but this Baker alone atop the pyramid thing to me is very. We've asked Shannon O'Brien about 42 times when she's been sitting where Peter Galzinis is. Don't you think the most effective thing that Mitt Romney used against you a decade plus ago was the Gang of Three argument?
Oh, it was
do you
great.
Want
it was
every
great.
Piece? Yeah. Do you want the Senate president, the Speaker, and the governor all to be of the same party, or do you want a little bit of a check and balance? Baker's the balance, but then there's Jeff McCormick, who's a very wealthy man who's able to self-fund, who is fairly similar in terms of resume to Charlie Baker.
He has never run before either. And you know, you see people make very beginner mistakes. Like when you asked him a couple of weeks ago if he knew who his state rep was, and he had no idea, which was, you know, not the be-all and the end-all, but it's indicative, I think, of a beginner's.
But you don't make mistakes in television ads, Marjorie. And when you got a lot of money
and
you only need to peel a few points off in a close election, it could be pretty significant.
What also about the idea of nurturing Republicans the way Democrats are nurtured in terms of the ground game, in terms of the door knocking, in terms of those kinds of things?
Mitt Romney, to his credit, what year was it, Frank Phillips, when Mitt Romney ran 101 Republicans
04.
For state rep and he lost every single
one
of the races?
He walked
right?
away from it. And it was also a bad time that it was. Kerry was the nominee for president, and it was a presidential election. It was the worst time in the world.
A lot of Democrats were going to come out to vote.
But do you think, Frank, that they do the nuts and bolts work that you know, Democrats have brought up, understanding they have to do.
They have a hard time doing that. But out in Worcester County, they're going to make some gains in the particularly the state Senate. The demographics have changed, and out in Worcester County has become hugely Republican. And there's some open seats there, and some incumbents like Richard Moore barely won re-election. He's been redistricted. It's going to be a tough fight for him out there. He's a longtime Democrat, and there's some open seats like Brewer in Barry, and it's going to be tough. And also, there's some of these groups out there, the conservative wing, the socially conservative wing of the party is building some grassroots organizations, getting reps elected,
right.
out using their town committees outside their towns, going into other areas of the state and funneling money. And so there is some rumbling there, but it is all coming from the right. And they're very smart this year. They're going to back Charlie Baker. They're going to put aside the social conservative stuff. And they've agreed with Charlie, your fiscal conservatism is something we can live with, and we'll go with you.
Well, that's the obvious problem for Republicans in this state. I think Massachusetts, obviously, is a very socially liberal state. So talk about small government. Talk about taxes. Talk about running things like the DCF the right way.
Gun control.
Talk about managing the government. But don't talk about, you know, gay rights and abortion. I mean, I think we've moved beyond that in Massachusetts. And when you see them talking about it, it's like, oh, my God, here we go again, you know.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Speaking of gay rights, last thing for you guys. There is a deal almost struck, which apparently is unstruck.
Unstruck,
to have
yes.
Gays
Laurel
march.
Sweet reports this morning in the
Herald.
Why don't
you say what she's said there?
Well, there was this, Peter wrote about it on Sunday, that there was this glimmer of hope because Mass Equality was their application to march in the St. Patrick's Day Parade was accepted by the honchos over there that include your buddy, John Wacko Hurley. They said the application was okay, but then the caveat was they could not right. march with anything indicated that they were gay, and the head of Mass Equality initially was happy about that. Now she's backtracked, and the group now, Laurel Sweet reports this morning that the group pushing to include gay veterans in the South Patrick's Day Parade has rejected this offer to march. This is Massaquoi in the condition they don't show any sexual.
You weren't very hopeful in your column on Sunday. You thought this was going no further. Is that a fair characterization of your position?
Well,
this is Peter
Gazzanis. I understand Wacko, and I understand the situation behind that in the sense that, you know, look, he's got a 9-0 Supreme Court validation. So he knows
it
that.
Says it says they have a First Amendment right to keep in or out exactly. anybody they want from
the
court.
So, you know, the world can change. We're in the 21st century. It doesn't matter. The thing is, but this situation now has more to do with Corradini, Kara Corradini, and the backlash.
Head of Mass Equality.
That she took initially because on Friday or Friday going into Saturday, she was hailing this slight movement to have Mass Equality in under their banner and nothing more. And then she took a hit, I think, from her constituency that said, look, this is just don't ask, don't tell all over again. So by late Saturday afternoon, you know, she retooled her statement to say we have to have this. And Marty told me and made it public that, you know, if Mass Equality can't march in the way that it feels comfortable, then he wouldn't march.
You know, this is the first of this. The Marty here is obviously Marty Walsh. This is the first thing in his 2 months in office where he's basically put his political capital in line. He's made a lot of pronouncements, Frank Phillips, about things he cares about, from urban violence and a whole variety of things, met with prisoners, that sort of thing. But he basically has helped broker this deal with Steve Lynch, the congressman, former senator from South Boston, and now says, I brokered a deal, but if half a loaf is not enough, and I totally understand that, I'm not marching this parade. It's a pretty dramatic move on his part for an early mayor, isn't it?
It is, but he also represents the whole city. Right. And a lot of the people who vote in this whole city are outside of Southie. So, you know, he's not entirely dependent upon that constituency.
He told us the other day he thought if there was a vote in Southie that 90-10 people would say we want inclusion in our parade, not
inclusion, exclusion. But do they want them to demonstrate with signs and saying, you know, what the big problem is now?
I think they wouldn't. I certainly think there wouldn't be any big pushback for Mass Equality to march with a banner and T-shirts or something like that. I think that the way where this gets blurred is the other protest groups who are in the parade that's a mile behind. Then, you know, you've got them sort of complaining about, you know, this isn't just a gay parade, quote unquote. This is Veterans for Peace.
Yeah.
This is a couple of other groups, you know, that feel that they want its forum too.
You know, I forgot you're a Southie lifer. Peter Galzinis.
Peter's on the parade roof.
Where do you?
He's out there every week cleaning up after the mess.
Why don't you give his home address, Marjorie, so people can knock on his door?
Yeah.
So, Peter, how do you? Where do you think South Boston is today?
Look, it's a totally in the 20 years that this issue has sort of been a reality. It wasn't a reality in the sense that Menino gave up on it in the beginning and decided he just wasn't going to deal with it. In that 20 years, the world in South Boston has changed dramatically. I think the thing is there is still a residue of feeling in people who bristle at that change, and this sort of symbolic situation is that, you know, Wacko has been able to hold back the hands of time. You know, he's been able to say, look, we can't, you know, 30 years ago you came in here and told us we couldn't go to the high school up the hill. Okay, 10 years after that, you forced us to desegregate the housing projects and say that you had to make units available to everybody across the city. And then, you know, 5 or 6 years after that, the real estate monster came in. And people sold out, and they sold to three-deckers, and three-deckers get chopped up into three condos. So you've seen – and then, of course, commercial real estate and big-time real estate on the waterfront, blah, blah, blah. So So you've got this whole dramatic change in so many different aspects, except this one. And it's
well,
it's,
and also there's going to be a same day of the parade. There's going to be a Haitian American woman emceeing St. Patrick's
Day.
Exactly.
Stand.
And you know, the Southie councilor who theoretically was going to join her on the podium has decided he's going to go to Limerick.
It's Bill Lynn.
So you know, but there are a certain group of people who see this as that he is essentially holding back this current of change. But I think by and large, you're right. By and large, most people in South Boston say enough is enough, that, you know, we don't care about this. We, you know, if gays want to march, fine, let them march. I mean, it's not that big a deal.
Last thing for you, Frank Phillips. If Deval Patrick had two choices, tell jokes yet again at St. Patrick's Day breakfast or be waterboarded, which would he choose?
Don't you get the sense?
I know a lot of members of the press who would have to cover that thing. Would rather be waterboarded than be closed in in that
yeah.
thing. It ain't quite what it used to be.
But
with Linda Dorsina Forey, it could be a totally different animal this time. Why
I think
not?
You should shut them both down.
Coming,
no more parade,
from
no
Concord,
more breakfast.
I defer to Peter on this. Our big parade is not St. Patrick's Day, but the Patriots Day parade.
Yeah, sure.
Celebrating the fact that we threw the British out of our country.
Right, exactly.
How's that working? Not in Northern Ireland. I don't know.
Okay.
Hey, Frank and Peter, it's great to see you both.
Frank Phillips is the State House Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Peter Gelsinis is the columnist for the Boston Herald. Thanks, you guys, both, for coming in. Up next, we're going to ask you about the St. Patrick's Day Parade predicament. That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
A federal law with very different local experiences.
The old system was built on all these disparities. That there are just inherent differences in the number of people who offer policies in different places.
The many different stories of the Affordable Care Act from Dante Chinney, director of the American Communities Project at American University. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Brown University's pre-college summer programs, where students can prepare for college success, experience college life, and make new friends from around the world. More than 300 courses available. brown.edu/summer. And Celebrity Series of Boston, presenting Ira Glass in Reinventing Radio, a look behind the scenes at This American Life, Sunday, March 9th at Symphony Hall. You can learn more at celebrityseries.org.
I'm Courtney Jolie Loudermilk. I'm from Manchester by the Sea, and I'm a WGBH sustainer. I love commuting in the morning with Bob C, and I love my evenings with Emily Rooney.
I know, so, I'm not used to being the lead story.
I know, you are the lead story.
I adore her, and I love that she reminds me that I have a responsibility to be an informed citizen.
We both come in and we say to each other, as if it were scripted, we say, what do you think Emily's position is on...
That I have the right to vocalize my opinions.
One person does it, then the next person, the next person, the next person. Are the problems really that bad? Are they really the governor's fault?
She's such a spitfire. I really do. I enjoy her.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
WGBH radio, it keeps me connected. It keeps me aware of local, domestic, and world events. I think that would draw anyone in to know that I heard this reliable information. I think they would want to support the cause as well.
God, that was great vintage. Emily, it is easy to do support that cause at WGBHnews.org or with a quick call to 888-897-9424. Good afternoon. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to WGBH during the first and only Monday of our March community campaign. Here to help us encourage you to get involved is Edgar B. Herwick III.
Yeah, and it's not just any Monday. Did you guys know it's Museum Monday? That's what we're calling it, Museum Monday.
Love that.
And the reason is because we have a really special offer on the table for those of you who are contributing, becoming sustainers. And sustainers are those folks who basically, they make a contribution to the station, but they break down their gift into monthly installments that automatically renew. You pick the price. So $5 a month, $10 a month, $15 a month, $100 a month, whatever you got, that works. But if you're able to become a sustainer right now, during Boston Public Radio, we can say thanks with two passes for free admission to the Peabody Essex Museum. I think Jared Bowen's going to be on the show a little bit later today.
He is.
And I mean, talk to that guy about how great that museum is.
It's my favorite museum. You know, I don't even need you. I love the place.
It is an awesome, awesome place in an awesome location. So
In Salem. Downtown Salem with all those great houses.
Wonderful place.
So, and all the witches.
Yes, and the witches. So two free passes to hang out with some witches at the Peabody Essex Museum and an 89.7 Eco Tote. So you can buy some stuff in the museum gift shop, stuff the Eco Tote with all kinds of stuff and know that you didn't use a bag. You're saving the environment. All good things if you can make a contribution right now in any amount. So this is your only chance to do this. These free passes are only available today, Monday, Museum Monday. So 888-897-9424 or you can give online at WGBHnews.com.
This is my favorite part of the Pledge Week. I get to thank people. Yes. I love this. Terry in Hingham. These are people who have already contributed, and we thank you. Tommy in Boston, Marlene in West Roxbury, Catherine in Upton, and an anonymous online donor from Sudbury. Thanks for keeping Marjorie and me employed. Actually, we mean that. It's just a little piece of the thing. I want to say thanks on behalf of everybody. Please make the call if you haven't already. It's 888-897-9424, or you just go online to wgbhnews.org.
Okay, you can really never say thanks enough. So that's what this March Community Campaign is all about, saying thanks. The short campaign will be over in just a few days, and I really would love the chance to say thank you to you. So today, right now, I hope you'll support this routine of yours and many of your family, friends, and neighbors by supporting 89.7 with a gift in any amount. It is really appreciated by so many.
That's true. And a gift in any amount right now is also going to get you entered to potentially win a contest. We have a really cool one, which is basically we're going to take the America's Test Kitchen and we're going to stuff it in your kitchen for a full year. We got all kinds of stuff. Annual subscriptions to their magazines. That's Cooks Illustrated and Cooks Country. A copy of their latest cookbook, which is called Cooking School, which is signed by the entire cast of America's Test Kitchen. And two VIP invitations to the actual test kitchen, which is in Brookline, if you didn't know, which is cool for a special taping of the show. So if you make a contribution in any amount right now, whether that's as a sustainer, whether that's a one-time gift, you're going to be entered, potentially win that. That is a pretty good deal. Here's the number, 888-897-9424. Keep in mind, Jim and Marjorie have been here on the air for about a year now.
Yes.
A year and a week, but who's counting?
That's right.
A year and 6 days. But look, the reason why they're here is because folks are stepping up and saying, I value this. Not only are they listening, but every once in a while they're digging in their pocket when they don't have to. And that's what we're asking you to do. You don't have to give a lot, just whatever works for you. Keep this show going strong on the air. 888-897-9424.
You know, Edgar listed some great incentives to get involved right now, but the real reason to get involved is because you believe in public broadcasting like we do, that it helps get you through the day, your commute, and that it helps your family, friends, and neighbors do the same. So please call 888-897-9424 or simply give online at wgbhnews.org.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with Morning Edition from NPR News. You know, there's an old New Yorker cartoon. It shows two people standing at a party. They're talking, and the man says to the woman, "It's not just my opinion. It's the opinion of somebody I heard on NPR." You hear something, and during a conversation, the subject comes up again, and you realize you know what's going on. You can talk about it. You understand the story. It's a pretty common refrain among people because this is where you come to get information in context. You rely on public radio, and we rely on you. Without your contributions, public radio reporters cannot afford to tell the stories that you want to hear. And that's the way it should be. You support public radio, you get the value. Your community does too.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. For the first time, lesbian and gay Bostonians may march openly. We don't know yet, in the city's traditional St. Patrick's Day parade. But how open is open if they're not allowed to wear shirts or hold signs bearing the word gay? And that's currently the offer being made by the organizers. Would this be a victory for the LGBT community, or is this a tepid compromise that makes St. Patrick's Day parade seem irrelevant? Is it time to do away with it? Our number is 877-301-8970. How big an issue is this for you as well? And, you know, I've heard a lot of people say it's only St. Patrick's Day parade. It's dated. Who cares anymore? It's really about, in my opinion, about inclusion, equality in Boston. And it's a symbolic thing that actually is, as far as I'm concerned, a pretty big deal, which is one of the reasons Mayor Walsh has spent so much energy and political capital. And this is one of his first things.
Well, I think this is hugely embarrassing for the city of Boston. I think it's embarrassing for for Irish Americans. I'm one of them. I just hate this whole idea that the St. Patrick's Day Parade has been associated with this bigotry that's gone on and on and on. And this handful of guys, including John Wacko Hurley, who is 74 years old, and as Peter Gelsinus writes in the Herald the other day, that this isn't going to change as long as Wacko Hurley's in control, because he doesn't care.
Why do you say that? They agree. First of all, I'm not saying it's a decent enough compromise, but under Wacko Hurley, they agreed that gay organizations could... Well, that's
if they could march in the closet,
Marjorie, that's step one. Walsh isn't giving up, and a lot of the organizations that represent gay and lesbian veterans hasn't given up.
Nobody should march in this parade, not a single
solitary. If there's no deal, I agree.
Nobody should march at all. There shouldn't be any bands. You shouldn't bring your kids to see it.
If there's no deal, I agree.
And I could get rid of the St. Patrick's Day breakfast as well, which has become a total disgrace, except for this year, because Linda Dorsey-Nefori, who's black and Haitian, and she's been taking Irish step dancing lessons, and the drama of that could be pretty good, because, of course...
Her kids are half Irish, by the way. She's married to an Irish guy from the Dorchester Reporter.
I think the step dancing is anticipation of the breakfast, is it not?
I have no idea.
I think she's beefing up her steps so she can do a little dance at the breakfast. So that makes it kind of exciting. But I just cringe when I go to the breakfast, which I've unfortunately had to do for many years, and I cringe at the parade because... The good people of South Boston are being maligned by this, and so are Irish Americans.
Well, yeah, the answer is, in my opinion, is fix it. If you can't fix it, then maybe entertain what you're talking about. But the reality is Walsh got them halfway, and I think it'd be great if they got the other way in 2 weeks.
I don't think it is halfway.
Well, I think considering what the opposition has been, we asked, the last question we asked, Mayor Walsh was here for an hour with us on Friday. He's with us for an hour the last Friday of every month. Here are the last words we spoke to him and the last words he spoke back at us last Friday. Are you going to be marching in the St. Patrick's Day parade? What's your, what would you say the odds are?
Yeah, I think I'm marching the St. Patrick's Day parade.
Now, keep in mind, he has said that if the Mass Equality is not happy with the offer being made by the parade organizers, he's still not going to march, but I think he's been relentless on this. He was with us Friday. A tentative deal was announced Saturday, but then it was clear what the conditions were, and they were unacceptable to a lot of the gay and a lot of the gay and lesbian groups. I think you're wrong, Marjorie. I am not convinced this is over at all. I think Walsh and Steve Lynch, the congressman, former state senator, former state rep from South Boston, I think they're committing to fixing this thing, and I think the pressure is there to have it fixed.
Well, if they do, that's great, but we just got an email from Tom who's saying if you expect people to march in the St. Patrick's Day parade without identifying themselves as gay, essentially a don't ask, don't tell thing, then Marty Walsh should march in the gay pride parade but not acknowledge that he's the mayor of the city of Boston. So
good line.
Yeah, I just, like
no,
I said.
No, the deal is ridiculous. I agree.
It's ridiculous.
Marjorie, if I had said to you Friday when Marty Walsh left our studio, in 24 hours, the organizers of the parade are going to agree that an organization that fights for equal rights for gays and lesbians is going to be allowed to march, even with conditions. Believe me, I'm not defending it. I'm just saying going to make at least that much of an offer. You would have said not one chance in hell. Is that correct?
I was surprised that their application was even accepted. But this is not, to me, a situation where the great line of Barack Obama, don't let the perfect get in the way of the possible.
I agree with you. I'm not disagreeing with you.
I don't think this is a case of the perfect getting in the way of the
possible. Keep fighting, then, is the answer.
I think that, well, or just get rid of the whole thing. Make it something that people don't want to be associated with and that people are embarrassed about.
Can I tell you something?
Boston should be embarrassed about it. Plus, we're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on this parade. I think it's $400,000 was the amount of money in police details. I'd rather see that money go someplace else in Boston than protecting this
parade. Can I tell you something? If it turns out that there is ultimately a deal cut that is satisfactory to the gay and lesbian marchers, it's a national story. It's a national and important step ahead.
Yeah, and how does Boston look right now?
Not good.
Bill de Blasio was marching in an alternative parade
in
Queens.
When you have a new mayor who has put more political capital in line on this issue than I would argue anything else in his first 2 months in office, I would say it looks pretty good, actually.
Well,
there are a handful of people, as you say, in South Boston who look atrocious, who maybe don't care, but I would argue the fact that Boston's leadership is fighting so hard, and a guy who used to march in the parade as a state rep has said, I will not march in the parade, even though I brokered a deal because it's unsatisfactory to gay and lesbian groups. I would say that's a pretty major step.
Well, obviously, this is huge for Marty Walsh because he campaigned on the guy that can get to yes, talking about how he could sit down at the negotiating table with the cops and the firefighters. providers and work out these reasonable contracts. So this is sort of his first get to yes.
Getting to yes.
Getting to yes. Okay, yeah. I'm close enough. That's one of the big platforms that he ran on that he said that other people like Tom Menino or John Conley ran against as mayor, couldn't get to yes because he doesn't have that. They don't have the negotiating skills. He does, so this is the first test of his negotiating skills.
Now, and by the way, to show what kind of a decent soul I am, our number, by the way, is 877-301-8970. Well, Marjorie has said that the breakfast should be canceled and is ignoring the fact that I emcee the television coverage of the breakfast. I am not arguing the Herald should shut down because I'm a far better person.
And what do you say every year when you go to the St. Patrick's Day breakfast?
I can't remember what I say. So long ago, I can't remember.
It is like a cringe-a-thon. It is a cringe-a-thon.
There's some fine moments. There's some moments that are not quite so.
Of Billy Bulger, the former state senator that used to run the St. Patrick's Day parade. Then it was great. Then it was terrific. It was fun. The lines were great. Now,
Jokes are fine. Step dancers are great. What's the name of the great Irish tenor who we had in the studio? We said was here a couple of weeks ago. Who sang? What's the name? Ronan Tynan. When Ronan Tynan sang 2 years ago, I don't know if he's singing. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know who's coming? I hope I'm not. Am I allowed to? I don't think I can disclose this. A fabulous band that everybody loves. I don't know if it's public yet.
Okay.
Is performing. It's going to be.
Yeah.
And Linda Dorsina Forey is changing the world.
So she'll be great.
It's going to be a great
this
event.
This year is an exception because it's going to be exciting because of the historic moment of Linda Dorsina Forey being there. But, you know, last year, the year before, you see these politicians like Joe Kennedy running for Congress or Elizabeth Warren running for Senate. Mm-hmm. They came in about 3 minutes before they had to talk, and they ran out of there so fast when they were through. The only person that greeted the room from beginning to end was Scott Brown.
The only Republican in the room, too, which made it even more interesting. Greg, you're in Norwood. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Greg, thanks for the call.
Thanks for taking my call. You know, sure. I understand all the sides on this, but as a parent, I'm getting close to asking when society decides. When do I get to decide when I have to have these conversations with my kids? I mean, this is a parade, and I don't know. When I got out of college in my late 20s, I wasn't looking to go to a parade. Okay.
Yeah.
So I think this is a family event, and I think that's what people are trying to walk. I know that's what Mr. Lynch is walking the line on. It's a family event, and so.
But what do you mean? What's Greg, the end of your sentence? I'm not clear where you're going with this.
Okay, my 7-year-old says, hey, Dad, what's gay? Why do I have to have that conversation
Greg, I don't know where your kid is in school, but in most schools in Massachusetts, they're having that conversation very early on because people who are gay get married and have kids in the school system, and your 7-year-old kid could very well be sitting next to a child whose parents are gay. So I think you got to, you know, move into the 21st century here. They're having that conversation in schools.
And Greg, if you want to decide what's right for your kid, well, some parents don't want kids to get engaged with the military. So you can't have any veterans in the parade either. This is what the world looks like in 2014, and what people like Marty Walsh and Steve Lynch, the congressman, are arguing for is let the parade represent what America looks like. And if you have to explain to your kid what, and I agree with Marjorie, he probably knows far more than you do, you think he does. If you have to explain to your kid what the world is like in 2014, so be it. But Greg, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970.
You know, by the way, you brought up another good point. This is really the Veterans for Peace, who are also exiled from this parade. They have to march behind the parade. This is very much a let's glorify the war kind of thing. And when these stories, the Veterans for Peace guys, whom I've interviewed over the years, are very upset because Wacko Hurley, Mr. War Veteran, never left the United States. And these guys
is that true?
Yes. And these guys have all these, awards for unbelievable bravery in Vietnam. The World War II guys are mostly gone by now, but Korea and Vietnam. And they're relegated as second-class citizens, and they were huge war heroes, and they are Veterans for Peace. That's too controversial for this Allied War Veterans group. You can't be talking about peace in a parade on St. Patrick's Day that's about Irish Catholicism or whatever it's supposed to be about.
Well, you know, I was not hopeful on Friday when Marty Walsh left, even though he was totally committed. I am far more hopeful. I still think there's going to be a deal cut. There are 13 days till it happens, and I think they're going to get there. Let's go to Dedham, where Sean is on the phone. Hey, Sean, welcome to Boston Public Radio. What's up?
Hey, guys, how are you?
We're excellent, thanks.
You know what, being a neighbor of Norwood, that first Neanderthal that you just talked to me, wow.
He wasn't a Neanderthal. Go ahead.
And this guy, is this calendar say like 1924 on it? Are you kidding me? Listen, one of the very simple solutions, Jimmy. Why don't we do this? Why don't we have get rid of Wacko and bring in the anyone, the gay people that want to walk rock? That's great. But you know what? Let Wacko leave. Give an EVP card on the way out the door.
Hey, Sean, if I lend you $20, can you get a new phone next time you call?
I'm sorry. I'm working out here. You know, I'm out in America working, Jimmy. I'm sorry.
Sean, it's great to hear from you. Thanks so much. By the way, for those who think, and people who are new to this debate may think we are using the term wacko, just like Sean did, in a disparaging way.
No, that's
this is what he calls himself. That's his nickname. It's John, right?
John Wacko Hurley.
And I knew you were going to say there was never a nickname. Don't even go there. I think people can think of that on their own. Let's go to Revere, where Holly is on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hi, Holly.
Hi. Are you?
Excellent. Thank you.
I think the parade is honoring Irish history. And while I could not walk in the parade because I'm a WASP, I'm not going to request that I carry a sign that says that I'm a WASP. But I think that this is a private matter. And I don't announce that I'm a heterosexual. I don't think people need to be announcing what their sexual persuasion is. And there are plenty of laws in place for the equal rights. And I just think they're taken away from the fun and the beauty of this. The next thing they're going to do is celebrate, you know, on Columbus Day. They're going to want to march in the Columbus Day. For goodness sakes, you know, just be who you are and enjoy life and just leave these parades alone.
Well, again, Holly, there were Irish veterans that wanted to that are gay that wanted to march in the parade, and a lot of the people that were initially protesting the gay exclusion were Irish gay people. And as somebody who's Irish, I mean, I don't think that celebrating gay rights is anti-Irish. I mean, I think that Ireland has made huge steps at recognizing gay rights, and the United States has. So, I just don't know who. I mean,
Marty Walsh is Irish too, isn't he? The guy who's leading the fight here.
His parents came here from
Ireland. I know. I was being facetious.
So to me, it's sort of a smear on Irish Catholics, or Irish Protestants, I suppose, too, as well. But I think a lot of the people over in South Boston are Catholics. That somehow Irish Catholics are anti-gay, which I don't think is true.
But Holly, thanks for your point of view. We appreciate it. Our number is 877-301-8970. And by the way, we're going to continue to follow this, needless to say. 13 days to go. I am, for once, a cup half full kind of person on this, thinking it will be resolved. Marjorie, and you were never a nattering nabob of negativity. You think it's finished, right?
I'm embarrassed by it, and I wish it weren't even happening.
I hear you, but I'm you don't think they'll cut a deal before the Sunday of St. Patrick's Day, and I do.
I hope you're right, but
I'm
very skeptical. Okay, next, it is time for All Revved Up. The Reverends Emmett Price and Irene Monroe weigh in everything from the Oscars to Obama's latest push to help young black men. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
We don't really feel safe sleeping someplace that a stranger has been in.
What's the reason behind the recent surge in home break-ins? We put that question to Belmont's assistant chief of police.
The items that are taken, the quick conversion to cash, that is really what is driving these kinds of trends throughout the state, is people with the need for opiates or heroin.
I'm senior investigative reporter Philip Martin with a look into some of the ripple effects of the heroin crisis this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Lesley University, where creativity empowers educators, artists, and counselors to turn their passions into their futures. Lesley University, what will you make happen? More information available at lesleyuniversity.edu. And Gentle Giant Moving Company, serving New England since 1980, now offering moving and storage services coast to coast, with offices in major cities across the country. More info at gentlegiant.com.
Hi, this is Jack Spear. When it comes to things you pay for, it can be easy to think that public radio is free. After all, you don't get a bill from us. There's no corporate owner telling us what we should report. In fact, we pretty much embody the idea of free speech. But the only way we can bring you the news every day is if you help pay for it with your voluntary contribution. Members pay for more than half of what it costs for us to cover and broadcast the news. But not all of you out there support us, so today we're asking you to contribute what you can, even for those who can't. Your contribution means we can keep free speech freely available for everyone. Thank you.
It's easy to do online, WGBHnews.org, or with a quick call to 888-897-9424. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Jim Browdy. You are listening to 89.7 WGBH during the first and only Monday of our March community campaign. Here in studio with me and Marjorie Egan is our colleague and buddy, Edgar B. Herwig III. Hey, Edgar.
Hey, and you know, in my opinion, there's nothing better than saying thank you. And that's what this whole campaign is about. We're here for a couple days, and we're basically on a thank you mission. We're on a thanking mission. We want to thank you and everybody who's making contributions during this campaign. The idea is to thank 3,000 people before the whole thing's over, which is a lot of people, but it's not that many if you do your part. I guarantee you there are more than 3,000 people listening right now. If everybody got to their phones and made a contribution right now, we could thank all 3,000 of them, and then it would be done. But that's probably not going to happen. That's okay. You just need to do your part, and we want to say that, more importantly, you have about I'm looking at the clock here, about 50 minutes left to have Jim thank you today. Jim lights up like a light bulb when he gets to thank people. This is,
yeah, I'm
like
big the on most, the thank you brigade. I really am. That's exciting. True. I mean, I love that.
So if you want to hear Jim thanking you personally, then make that contribution right now. Here's the number, 888-897-9424. Or you can do it if you're listening online right now. It's really easy. Right there at WGBHnews.org, a couple of clicks of the mouse, and it's done.
That's right. And today we're looking for just 18 more people for Jim to thank before the show ends, so you could be the next one. Sometimes it's the little things that mean the most. For example, $10 a month might not sound like a lot of money, but as a sustainer, it would have a meaningful impact in this community. Here's why. As a sustainer, your gift of $10 a month would automatically renew each month, and that helps 89.7 plan better. Better plans mean fewer fundraisers. Who doesn't love that, Jim?
I know. Let me try practice for a minute. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. I mean it, and so does Marjorie. You know, it's not too often that you find something that's reliable, it's convenient, it's affordable. That's exactly what you get as a WGBH supporter. It's here 24 hours a day, whenever you need it. Marjorie and I were huge fans of the station long before we got here. There's no minimum to give. All it takes is a couple of minutes and your credit card. You call 888-897-9424, or you simply give online at WGBHnews.org.
So I'm looking at the clock again. It's 10 minutes after 1, so is it okay to talk about beer?
Sure. Absolutely.
So let's talk about beer. If you can become a sustainer right now for a gift of $10 a month, that's just $10 a month. As Jim was saying, that's not a lot. That's a couple of cups of coffee at a fancy coffee place. It's a week's worth of tolls, or it's probably that's probably less than a week's worth of tolls. $10 a month, and we can say thanks with a pair of tickets to our spring beer event, which is happening right here at WGBH, right here in Brighton, Thursday night, March 20th, 6 to 8. We're going to have a whole bunch of local breweries here, including Jack's Abbey, Hopsters Brew, Trogs Brewing Company, all with their like special, delightful spring brews. You know, they'll be like, you know, the notes of grass or whatever it is that they put in their spring brews. But the tickets for this are super limited. This is a really limited ticket event. So if you become a sustainer right now, $10 a month, two tickets coming your way, and Jim's going to thank you in the next break. Very exciting stuff right now. 888-897-9424 or online at WGBHnews.org.
So please help out however you can today and take advantage of the special offers on the table. Remember, we're on a thank you mission, and we want to say thanks to you, so I hope you'll do your part right now. Here's the number and website one more time, 888-897-9424, or get involved online at WGBHnews.org.
Trogs Brewing Company, Jack's Abbey, Hopsters Brew and Boards, Brooklyn Brewery. And that's just a few of the top-notch craft brewers you'll meet at the Taste of WGBH Spring Brews event. Come on over to WGBH's place right here in Brighton on March 20th and wet your whistle with some of the finest spring craft brews around. Hey, why not bring a friend? It's just one way we can say thanks for supporting WGBH as a sustainer with a gift of $10 a month or more. Secure your pair of tickets to the Taste of WGBH Spring Brews event when you sign on as a sustainer. Call 888-897-9424 or make it happen online at WGBHnews.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Here's one of the few times, at least in my opinion, Ellen DeGeneres was actually funny last night at the Oscars.
Anything can happen. So many different possibilities. Possibility number one, 12 Years a Slave wins Best Picture. Possibility number two, you're all racists.
Joining us to derive meaning from last night's Oscar winners and losers, among other important issues, is Reverend Irene Monroe. Irene is a syndicated columnist. You can find her at Bay Windows and the Huffington Post. And Reverend Emmett Price, he is a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture, Towards Bridging the Generational Divide. Great to see you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So was there any larger significance of 12 Years a Slave winning? It didn't do as well in the box office. Lots of people said they were going to be too upset by going to see the movie, but it won. Do we take it? Is there any takeaway to this, or is it just, it was a great movie, great acting, it won, end of story?
This is one of the best movies ever made that one probably didn't enjoy. I mean, you know, when you think about the movie was flawless in its appreciation for this narrative of Solomon Northup. True story, which is an important point. And a memoir that he wrote himself and published in 1853, right? And folks forgot about the memoir, really, until, you know, the early 20th century. And then 1984, there was a great kind of documentary done by Gordon Parks, the great artist and filmmaker. But again, the story is not well known.
And what also is not well known is that most of his narrative was appropriated by Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Yes.
And this is how we get Uncle Tom's Cabin, because she used a lot of the factual material from his narrative for her narrative. And interestingly enough, truth be told, he wrote his narrative long before she did. But again, the whole idea of how they wanted to stage the abolitionist movement, she had to come out of the gate first with her book that became quite popular.
So let me ask you, because somebody just emailed about how they waited 10 years before they saw Schindler's List. So did I. I watched it on a small screen TV, and I have not seen this movie because I hate to go to movies and get all upset. I mean, were you having, like, was it stuck in your head for like a week and a half, 2 weeks after you saw this movie?
Oh, I was upset.
Yeah.
I mean, because one of the things is, it's the overload in terms of the torture. Someone called, unfortunately, Steve McQueen's film, torture porn. But the point about it is, you know, slavery is torturous. And it is equally as torturous watching those images in Steve McQueen's film as we did in Schindler's List.
And it takes a black Brit to come and hold the mirror to us as quote-unquote Americans, for us to look at our historical past. I mean, that says it all, right? That we have a challenge of not really wanting to face our history and deal with our history, but then we look at where we are in present times and we act like it doesn't make sense. It makes complete sense.
Or Emmett, or this, we will watch it if it's Django Unchained, because it plays into a lot of stereotypes. It makes everybody feel quite comfortable. One of the arguments about Steve McQueen's 12 Years a Slave is that it lacked a resistant narrative, failing to see.
What do you mean a resistant narrative?
Well, you know, in Django Unchained, you know, Jamie Foxx is the hero in this narrative. He's a familiar figure, too. So it distanced you from saying, well, you know, this is all make-believe. We know that, you know, this will end, this kind of suffering. But when you get someone that is not known like Lupina, it brings it really to the fore. I just want to say this. The real question is that you haven't seen it, but so too haven't a lot of African-Americans.
Well, it's done better, to your point, Emmett Price, it's done better in Europe than it has in the United States.
Absolutely.
Because probably we still feel too guilty about the whole
and shame and embarrassment around it and stuff. And I got to just say this, another thing that, you know, is very interesting. A lot of my white liberal friends who went to see, like, Irene, you must go see this. And one of the things they don't really understand is, and Emma and I was talking about, there are two things. One is that, like everybody else, we want to go to the theater to escape.
Yeah.
And the suffering that we endure in terms of micro and macro levels of racism, watching that film does not do very much for us in terms of trying to find a moment to leave this kind of, you know, ongoing oppression.
What's the name of the woman who co-hosted the Golden Globes with Tina Fey?
Amy
Poehler, whose great line was, you know, I saw 12 Years a Slave, totally changed my view about slavery. I thought that was just a fabulous. So my understanding is, unlike all the other Academy Awards, if it's a director, only directors vote. If it's artistic, whatever, only they vote. Special effects, same deal. The only thing I think everybody votes for well, it will confirm this with Jared Bowen when he comes in next, is Best Picture. The vast majority of members of the Academy are white, and I believe the vast majority of those who are white are men.
Did they vote
for this, Emmett Price, because they thought it was the best movie, or because they thought, we got to vote for this. It's a really good movie. It wasn't our favorite, but we got to do it because we're going to look like total, like Ellen DeGeneres joke. We're going to look like racists if we don't vote for
it. The old adage is 80% of every joke is truth.
Mm-hmm.
I think Ellen had it right on the money. I mean, I think there was this kind of, you know, Lady Liberty holding up, you know, whether we're going to be honest about the Best Picture or deal with our white guilt.
Do you think it was the best picture? Or do you think it was a hugely important picture that be made about a story that is vastly undertold? Well, let me get Emmett.
Okay.
What do you think about it? Was it the best picture of the year?
I thought it was the best picture of the year for a number of reasons, even more than those that are the requirements for the best picture of the year.
How about you, Irene?
I experience cognitive dissonance. How does you know, Dallas Buyers Club, you know, get best supporting actor and best actor and don't get, you know, get best film? I really felt that this was a corrective. But I feel like this is the wrong venue. I don't think that the theater should be the place that to substitute or fill in where our history books refuse to talk about this subject matter. Also, I just think that to put it in a kind of entertainment venue in many ways cheapens the severity.
I couldn't disagree with you more. Yeah. I have to say, it seems to me that the only things we talk about in 2014 I'm talking about the average person. I include myself in this, sadly, are things we see on television and in the movies. And the vast majority of us are not going to sit down and read a serious treatise on slavery and then go out and have the infamous conversation we have never had.
But my guess is
this or a television show that is provocative and makes you uncomfortable is much more likely to provoke some sort of reaction and discussion than what you're suggesting.
This movie did and will do what Roots did 40 years ago.
Because
for this generation that is coming up, these young people, they're not going to go back to that book. They're not going to deal with the curriculum in the classroom. They're going to deal from a framework of social media. They're going to deal from a framework of popular media. They're going to deal from a framework of what was on television and cinema and videos are the most important things.
But Emmett, you know what? When Roots came out, there was a paucity of black images just in the movies. Today we see a lot more. This is not a sea change. It's a corrective, but it's not a sea change because, you know, when you even poll our young, you know, kids, they prefer seeing Jamie Foxx and, you know, the sister from Scandal. Kerry Washington and, you know, Django Unchained. That works for them.
What about, you know, I wonder what the impact was of The Wire, which I thought was a great television show and certainly explains a lot of the in Baltimore, but the pathology you see with poverty and everything else in the inner city. I mean, was that widely watched among young African Americans? I have no idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And that gave
you a real understanding if you're a white person living in the suburbs how difficult these kids have it.
It spoke. But, you know, another reason why a lot of blacks will not go to this movie, whether they're living in Cambridge or they're in Dorchester, is that the pain that is displayed on that film, as Emmett said, Emmett watched it this morning in the confines of a safe space. And to view it in a public space is too vulnerable. It feels like voyeurism. You know, at the expense of your pain and suffering, that's not bringing about very much change. I think what this film did this year, being nominated as the best film, is that we have a black woman who now who's president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. And in many ways, she's saying, I'm here. And what she's also done is she has diversified that white pool of heterosexual men.
And this movie makes us have this conversation, which is why it's important.
Well, right? Did you watch it on TV?
No.
You watched it at the theater?
No, I watched it this morning. I watched it this morning.
On a computer or television or a big screen?
Well, I mean, you know, in the barbershop around here. Now, you know, I had a private viewing.
Okay.
But The Butler was nowhere around.
That's right.
Long Walk to Freedom was nowhere around. Now, but you start talking about snubs. These are two snubs. This movie was imperative to be made in 2013 and to be in this award show because we're going to have this conversation for a long time.
But see, well, I didn't think that Mandela's film was snubbed. To be quite honest, I've seen better documentaries than the film. I mean, I love the guy that played it, and he just looked handsome to look at. But that just wasn't good. I do feel The Butler, in many ways, did get snubbed. I thought Oprah was fabulous. I just think that, again, we've had a number of films that dealt with slavery. If you remember when Beloved came, that too bombed at the box office. The only one really slave film.
It was a very tough book.
It was. The only slave film that worked was Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind.
But I think the difference here is this is not a slave film. It's a memoir.
Yeah.
Right? It's an autobiographical story told by the individual himself about his 12-year saga, right, as a slave. And there's no happy ending.
Yeah, we should have said, by the way, just realize, Emma, when you're talking, there's probably still a piece of our audience that doesn't even know what it's about. This is the mid-1800s.
Before
there's
Civil
a free
War.
Man, and where is it, Saratoga Springs?
That's
is that where
it
is in
right.
New York? And all of a sudden, he's taken away, and he's a slave for 12 years.
Well, he was lured because we understand he was a musician. He's a fine musician. And he would travel, you know, up into Canada and New England and around the country as a musician. And he was lured into slavery, right, and then sold to Washington, D.C. And by the way, it's his memoir that helped us understand that it was actually slavery in Washington, D.C. And then he was stolen again was sold into slavery in New Orleans.
But, you know, to me, the hermeneutic of suspicion in this that doesn't get played out is that, okay, how many blacks were really in Saratoga Springs? This is where this is an inside conversation that this is also a man who didn't see himself as the slave hands on a plantation. And a lot of that had to do with white skin privilege. He had a wife that could pass as white, and he was very light-skinned. So truth be told, he did not see him. He was just outraged by the fact that someone of his skin color and privilege and education, because he was literate, the audacity of these folks to not recognize his humanity.
Which is another reason why the movie is important, because it breaks down that traditional stereotype and that phenotype of slaves.
But one last thing, too, about this is that I never knew this happened. I had no idea. And
Reason the movie's important.
Yeah, I was an American history major, and I had
no idea
that you could grow up in a free state, be a free man, and be dragged back into slavery. I just didn't even know about it.
So we've been talking about whether or not the movie will provoke a conversation. I would hope that the following provokes a conversation. This is Barack Obama at the White House just a couple of days ago announcing his new program to help young black men. In particular, it was called My Brother's Keeper. Listen to him.
I didn't have a dad in the house, and I was angry about it, even though I didn't necessarily realize it at the time. I made bad choices. I got high without always thinking about the harm that it could do. I didn't always take school as seriously as I should have. I made excuses. Sometimes I sold myself short. And I remember when I was saying this, Christian, you may remember this, after I was finished, the guy sitting next to me said, are you talking about you?
Yeah, I love that. I love that line, by the way. And I watched the president's speech the other day. The president took a huge amount of blowback when he said that could have been my son after the Trayvon verdict thing. I think this was potentially a really big moment. And the debate is, so far, it's only been a few days, is less about what the president had to say, I think, Irene Monroe, and more about, are blacks in America still feeling that Barack Obama is not addressing the plight of black Americans? Because he is black, and he wants to make clear he's the president of all people. What was your take on what he had to say?
Well, you know, I was very happy, actually, to hear him do this, because for many reasons. One is that he hasn't spoken about race for a lot of good reasons. He made a wonderful statement this summer, and I remember this, when he says, you know, and he was talking about Trayvon Martin, and he says, America has to really invest in our African-American men. I was very happy to hear that. I think what bothers me most is that the narrative is always about saving the black man at the expense of just nothing about black women, because we too are profiled. We too are in prison. You did a wonderful piece, Marjorie, showing how we get, you know, caught up in the prison.
Thank you.
So my whole idea, we follow kind of what I call hierarchy of oppression. Who's more oppressed within our African-American community? Well, we all all are. So we need it seems like a more of a token kind of effort here, because it really needs to come out of all of us being, you know, participants in it and realizing that we all got to climb out of this.
Do you buy that analysis, Emmett Price? I didn't think it was tokenism at all, unless he doesn't do anything to follow up. And the biggest problem is the disappearing young black man in black communities. And women
we're
are less staying there
Jim,
holding
we're
the bag.
Disappearing. What?
What was your take on what Obama had to say the other day, Emmett Price?
I love the fact that he was transparent. And I love his passion of his ability to
transparent. You mean when he's saying I got high all the time?
Yeah,
I love
his transparency, because it breaks him down from being this kind of immortal, you know, present to being a real person. The challenge is that I'm not sure that the real issue will get had at, right? It's not little black boys who are the problem. It's society who is the problem, right? And as much as I love the investment of the time and energy in terms of supporting our young black boys, the issue is society, right? And so I'm glad that he was transparent. I'm glad that he was passionate about this, and this he found something as he determines his legacy that he can, you know, kind of hang his shingle on. But I mean, the proof is in the pudding. You know, fixing young boys in the street, first of all, they need to be fixed. But I don't think that's a presidential initiative. I think that's a local initiative.
It's too tokenized. It really is. Because here you'll have a handful of, you know, black young men who have succeeded through this program. And you've done nothing systemically to change the prison system, the education system, all the ways in which would cause a tremendous sea change that not only would impact the lives of young, you know, little brothers coming up, but also sisters as well. So I just feel like, again, yes, we recognize that there's a problem here, but I just think that the approach is it's just reinscribing the problem.
Well, you both just said this is a local problem, and obviously it's got to be dealt with back home, as so many things do. I think this guy who's been so criticized for not addressing these kinds of issues, using the bully pulpit of the presidency to talk about the issue and to be, and I couldn't agree with you more on this one piece, Emmett Price, this transparency. When you hear the most powerful person in the world saying what we already know, we know he talked about it in his books, but when he says, what was the line again? He says, I got high without thinking about the harm it could do. When I heard him say the words the other day, I almost did a double take. And so if he, Irene Monroe, he's got to set the tone in many ways and say, mm-hmm. and apparently there's going to be a couple hundred million bucks if he has his way here attached to this thing that allows people back home with this.
There are two things here. One of which is when he, if he had heard the speech, he says, you know, I grew up in a system that was a lot more forgiving.
And that was
quite important.
Yeah.
And how to make this system.
He meant for him.
It was in Hawaii,
that's
in a
right.
white school. Private school.
How
right?
do we set up a system that is also forgiving and allow you to have 2, 3, 4, 5 chances? But then my overall assessment is this. If, you know, when his reign is over, I'll say, you know, I'll look at it and I'll say, well, if he did well, he was a good black president for us all, for all of America. And if he, you know, should not succeed, I'll just say, well, what's up with the half white boy in the White House? I mean, I'm just going to split it down the middle.
Don't you think part of this, though, is the Nixon? And by the way, I am not among those who say that he should not deal with these issues, because the reality is a black president, you got to make clear that you're not just focused on issues that you can most directly relate to. But it's almost like a Nixon gone to China thing. I mean, it is. I mean, LBJ, a Southern Democrat, is the only guy beyond his skills, but because he was a Southern Democrat, who could talk to these other senators and talk about civil rights reform. A liberal from the North was not going to be able to pull that off. So I think, considering the constraints and considering the criticism, I think the guy stepped up the other day. And the issue is there follow through, or is this just one of many things that politicians talk the talk and then end up not walking
the walk? This is not only a race issue, but this is also a class issue. What about Latino boys? What about poor white boys? I mean, that kind of dysfunctional behavior that we're talking about that comes out of these communities is across the board.
Yeah, but he was not teaching a class, Irene Monroe, the other day. He was trying to catch the attention of the American people, I think. And he did it in a way that had most staying power.
It was safe.
What?
I think it was a safe.
Well, I hope you're wrong.
So I was thinking to myself, he's in that prison with a bunch of guys that are in there for whatever they've done wrong. And I'm thinking, he did have such a different upbringing. I mean, he
Hawaii is quite different.
Hawaii's
okay.
quite different.
Than Philly and Boston.
Very different. And,
Brooklyn.
And you're looking at guys that probably didn't have much of a chance because they were in a gang at 11 when they wanted to be or they didn't want to be because they were scared about, you know, surviving. So to me, it was such a different, his experience.
That's right. And I also think this, that, you know,
different.
When you're a minority in an environment, you know, like he was, I mean, you become not so much a criminal, you become exotica to white people. Okay. So if you misbehave, I mean, he's right. It's less, it's forgiving because it's like, well, we're going to try to help this
yeah.
one. We're going to
yeah.
help this particular one.
So do we have time to talk about the parade here before we go?
Well, I thought we were going to talk about, well, you can talk about
the sleepwalker.
Oh, no, the sleepwalker. Okay, the sleepwalker. Yeah, there was a fascinating piece by a Bostonian who does it. Bostonian, is it
Blackstone.
Blackstonian.
Jamal Crawford, about this statue, this piece of sculpture that was over at Wellesley College.
We've talked about it here. Yeah.
Shows a guy in his underpants, a white guy, sleepwalking across campus, and it caused a ruckus because a lot of women at Wellesley thought, oh, this is
creepy.
Like creepy. And Crawford raises this fascinating question about, suppose this were a black guy. Now, I'm fascinated. Miss Wellesley graduate
That's
over
right.
there. I
That's
mean,
right.
What do you think?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is it helps you to look through this through a number of lenses. You know, white skin privilege, number one, heterosexuality, because no really gay boy, okay, with any fashion sense would be seen in those drawers.
Tidy whities.
Okay? And also through the lens of sexual violence. But yeah. absolutely. That, you know, and the issue, I went on campus to look at this and just also talk to some of the women on campus. And it also brings up issues of sexual violence, you know, their personal history. And the whole notion that, you know, someone in some white drawers, you know, in the scene of whites. I mean, he just blends in, and then he doesn't blend in. He sticks out. He's creepy looking.
So what's your answer to the question?
And he looks too old to be anybody's boyfriend.
What's your answer to the question that's posed in Blackstonian.com? What if the statue was black? What do you think would the reaction? How different, if at all, would the reaction have been?
Oh, Monroe? Campus police would have come and removed
that's
it.
That's what he thinks.
Oh, without a doubt. And first, they might have shot at it first to make sure.
Well, see, I think exactly
it.
The opposite. I think white guilt would have – the 900 people who signed the petition would never have signed a petition, and we'd barely be hearing about it. You don't agree with me, Emma.
It would not have been approved in the first place. It would have never went up.
And what brother would be in his drawers? Okay. Like that.
What are you wearing, Irene?
Okay.
Please tell us.
I mean, really?
I mean, even the sculpture would be scared
okay.
for its own life. I mean,
okay,
you know,
absolutely.
it wouldn't
okay.
be up.
All right, and particularly since he's not packing.
Yeah.
I mean, in the front, I mean, not on the side.
My
I mean,
goodness.
That would just not work.
I don't
okay?
think the detail was at all necessary
well,
to this conversation,
saying, you know.
But thank you very much.
Okay, we don't have time for the parade, or do we have time
No,
for
I
the
think
parade?
After that we have no time for anything.
We don't have time for the parade. Okay, I'm sorry, we can't get to the parade this week.
Well, the
Maybe
parade's
off
for
week.
2 weeks.
For
Maybe
2 weeks,
next
we'll
week.
Have time. Okay, thank you both for being here. I guess no one was a big fan of the sculpture over there at Wellesley College. Reverend Irene Moore is a syndicated columnist.
Monroe, too.
Monroe, excuse me. You can find her at Bay Windows in the Huffington Post. Reverend Emmett Price, got that correct, is a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. Thank you again for coming in. Up next, Jarrett Bowen joins us for his take on the Oscars. He's been tracking these movies throughout the year. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Well, a St. Patrick's Day Celtic sojourn reflects the relaxed nature of a Celtic sojourn, the radio program.
WGBH's Brian O'Donovan.
We are adding a third show in Worcester this year. Central Massachusetts is a very Irish area and has a lot of folks there as well who are interested in Irish culture. Bringing a St. Patrick's Day Celtic sojourn to Worcester is a natural extension of what we've been doing for the last 8 years.
Reserve your seats at wgbh.org/Celtic.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Dover Rug and Home. Rugs, carpeting, hard surfaces, and window treatments for today's lifestyle and many budgets. You can visit Dover Rug's new showroom in Natick, featuring a squash club, or doverrug.com.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with Morning Edition from NPR News. You know, there's an old New Yorker cartoon. It shows two people standing at a party. They're talking, and the man says to the woman, "It's not just my opinion. It's the opinion of somebody I heard on NPR. You hear something, and during a conversation, the subject comes up again, and you realize you know what's going on. You can talk about it. You understand the story. It's a pretty common refrain among people because this is where you come to get information in context. You rely on public radio, and we rely on you. Without your contributions, public radio reporters cannot afford to tell the stories that you want to hear. And that's the way it should be. You support public radio, you get the value. Your community does too.
Online at WGBHnews.org if you want to contribute to us, and I hope you do, or call 888-897-9424. Good afternoon. I am Marjorie Egan. I'm so glad you're here because it's the first and only Monday of our March community campaign. And joining me in studio today is not just Jim Browdy, who's here every day, but Edgar B. Herwick III.
True, and it's not just any Monday, Marjorie. It is Museum Monday because today only we have a really special offer for anybody who becomes a sustainer today. Sustainers are people who make a contribution, but they break that contribution down into monthly installments that automatically renew. And we can thank you for becoming a sustainer at any amount. You pick it, $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever. We're going to say thanks with two passes for free admission to the Peabody Essex Museum and our brand new 89.7 Eco Tote, which is a, you know, just a lovely bag, just a wonderful bag. You can put anything in it. I mean, all kinds of things in this sturdy Eco Tote.
I love that name.
Yeah, the Eco Tote.
Yes.
It's so public radio. and you can bring it to the Peabody Essex Museum with you. So here's how you make a contribution. It's very simple. You make a phone call at 888-897-9424. Or if you're listening online, you can give there at WGBHnews.org. Pick the amount that works for you. Support Jim and Marjorie, Boston Public Radio, and everything you hear on the airwaves here.
And here's why I'm here, to do the thank yous, my favorite thing. Rena in Boston, thank you. Rebecca in Weston, Frederick in Cambridge. We also heard from people in Norfolk and Salem. Michael in Weston. And Marjorie, I would agree. I think you'll agree this next person is a very astute listener. Here's what Ellen in Providence said when she made her contribution.
What'd she say?
I am addicted to Jim and Marjorie.
Oh, good.
Yes. Doesn't get much better,
Ellen,
than that.
We love you.
Now,
we
here's the deal. We love you all. We're looking for 11 more people to love and thank. So that means you and 10 others. You do this online at WGBHnews.org. It really is incredibly simple. You call 888-897-9424.
Okay, the goal right now is to say thank you to 11 supporters in the next 20 minutes. Just imagine you along with the other 10 supporters in a line outside the studio, and Jim and I are just walking down that line, shaking hands and saying thank you one by one. I hope you're the next person we can thank, and we'd love to be able to thank you. All is a gift in any amount, 888-897-9424, or give online at WGBHnews.org.
It's like a Jim and Marjorie parade. Where everyone
That's right.
is welcome.
No, That's right.
And all shapes and forms are welcome in the Jim and Marjorie parade right now at 888-897-9424. Talked about becoming a sustainer at any level, and you can get your hands on that pair of tickets to the Peabody Essex Museum. But if you're already a member there or something like that, how about a gift of $10 a month right now, and we can thank you with a pair of tickets to our Spring Beer event, which is happening March 20th. That's right. That is the first day of spring, or right around the first day of spring. 6 to 8 p.m. right here at the WGBH Studios, which is a great location if you've never been here for something like this. We're going to have a bunch of local brewers here. They're going to be unveiling their spring brews, and you'll be tasting and enjoying. So that's if you can become a sustainer right now. $10 a month. We can thank you with those tickets. And like we said, sustainer at any amount right now. You can choose a pair of tickets to the Peabody Essex Museum plus the Eco Tote. So 888-897-9424 or WGBHnews.org. You got about 20 minutes left to do it today during Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie.
I am so at that local brewers thing. Let me just tell you. You know, yes. Edgar just listed some great incentives to get involved right now, but we all know the reason, the real reason to get involved is because you believe in public broadcasting, as do we, that it helps get you through the day, through your commute, and that it helps your family, your friends, your neighbors, the people you care about to do the same. Please call 888-897-9424 or give online at WGBHnews.org.
There's this place right here in New England where time travel is real, where you can explore ancient civilizations, meet 18th century Chinese merchants, even dance with dragons and sail the seven seas, all without leaving the North Shore. Today only, become a WGBH sustainer, and the Peabody Essex Museum will say thanks with two passes for free admission. And to help you pack for the adventure, 89.7 will toss in our brand new WGBH Eco Tote. Call 888-897-9424 or become a sustainer online at wgbhnews.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan joining us today over last night's Oscar Award winners and losers. And what has the longest shelf life of what happened last night is WGBH's arts editor, Jared Bowen. He also hosts the TV show Open Studio. Jared, good to see you.
Great to be with you both.
Hello, Jared. So new, well, she's been back. She's done it before, but she was back again last night. Ellen DeGeneres, what'd you think?
I thought she was great. She delivered what that room needs, because that room, everybody talks about how stuffy that room is, and of course people are starving, and they've been starving themselves for 8 months prior just to get into their clothes so that they look good on the red carpet. And then she got it, and then they get in there and they're of course so tense about whether or not they'll win. And first of all, you have to remember that everybody probably knows Ellen DeGeneres personally because they've been on her talk show at some
point.
So she comes out and it's her Ellen humor, which I've seen her do her stand up prior to her talk show, and she's just so cute and affable and fun and somewhat innocent, although I thought she was slightly edgy last night, a little more edgy than I've ever seen her before. And I think she put the whole room at ease. I'm not sure why she was dressed up like John Adams going to a disco. But other than that, I thought that she was fantastic.
Well, how about her Glenda the Good Witch outfit? I thought that was great. It was so funny.
Now I'm totally guilt-ridden by saying I thought she underperformed. And, you know, I like edginess a lot in these kinds of things. The one time she was edgy, I thought she so crossed the line. I think virtually nothing crosses the line. But listen to this. Here she jokes about Liza Minnelli. Liza Minnelli, as you know, is the daughter of Judy Garland. It was a tribute to the 75th anniversary of The Wizard of Oz. Minnelli, her sister and brother were there. And Liza Minnelli, if you saw her before, looks really like she's having a tough time. I mean, she looks really, I don't know what her issue is, but she clearly has some. Listen to what Ellen had to say about her, which, again, I thought was really unkind.
To say one of the most amazing Liza Minnelli impersonators I have ever seen in my entire life. Just really, seriously. Good job, sir. I mean, that is really.
Yeah. Ordinarily. Well, Jared's laughing. I think that's the answer. We know what he thought. I thought that was a creepy moment and really unfair.
But it could have gone either way, because I think the only reason that you feel that way is because Liza Minnelli had this horrified look on her face when that happened.
Did.
But you don't know if she was horrified because she doesn't know where she was at that moment, or if she was just really upset by what Ellen DeGeneres had said. If she had laughed, I think it would have been really funny.
Maybe so.
And it was pretty funny, I think. I mean, as people have pointed out, Liza Minnelli did not have a great night, because later on in the show when Ellen took the selfie with all of the picture that killed Twitter for a little while last night.
That was a great moment of the show. I agree.
I thought so too. I'll get back to what I was just about to say, but I felt a couple times things I didn't think were going to work, like the pizza, like the selfie. I found myself really drawn to them in the end. I thought they were really funny. But what I was going to say about that selfie is there's a picture taken behind the selfie picture taking, and you see Liza Minnelli there in her big blue ensemble and hair trying to get up there in the selfie, and she just didn't quite make it.
Now I feel worse about the whole thing.
I thought she was good too, because it's not, you cannot be too edgy in that situation, I don't think. It doesn't really work. And I thought that the lottery ticket she gave to Bradley Cooper was pretty funny too. So I thought she was good. I liked her a lot.
Well, she brings them down to a human level. All of these, I think we're so apt to look at all these people as unreachable. They're all up on these pedestals.
No, you make good points, Jared, actually. She does humanize him in a lot of ways, and so I'm going to totally change my position. Is that okay?
Did I win?
I think you did.
Yes,
yeah, speaking
you did.
Of win, the only award, the only nominee who I think the conventional wisdom was a 100% winner, was Best Supporting Actor from Dallas Buyers Club, Jared Leto. I assume you were there too, right, that this guy was clearly going to win?
Definitely, absolutely.
And I'm going to play a little piece of his acceptance, but it's the last negative thing I'm going to say, I promise. I don't want to be negative, because I actually enjoyed most of the show.
You've been the Pollyanna so far. What are you
talking
about?
I know, I have no idea. Here's Jared Leto. Well, you changed my mind. Here's Jared Leto talking a little politics in the middle of his acceptance speech. Here it is.
To all the dreamers out there around the world watching this tonight in places like the Ukraine and Venezuela, we are here. And as you struggle to make your dreams happen, to live the impossible, we're thinking of you tonight.
Oh, my God. Let me tell you, I had just finished going to Boston.com to print out all my nominees, and I see the slideshow of the $85,000 of swag that is in the bag for every nominee, And Jared Leto says, we're here for your struggle. We're thinking.
Yeah,
I mean, come on. I mean, you didn't mind that one either?
No, because, I think you have to look at who he is. Just like Ellen, that's her style of delivery. Jared Leto is somebody who came out of nowhere. He had been out of filmmaking for quite some time because he's just been touring the country and I think the world in his little band making music. And then he signed up for this little movie that wasn't supposed to do anything, this little movie that nobody wanted to make because it had been turned down so many times. And then in the most unlikely circumstances, he lands himself up there on Oscar night, probably didn't even have to campaign that much, and then he wins. So I think he was perfectly within his right, and I am somebody who abhors when celebrities take their celebrityness or their celebrity, I'm making up words now, to exhort some political platform or political agenda. I mean, even I was reading over the weekend that even Jane Fonda, when she won in the 70s, when she was in the thick of everything, she demurred and did not go there. But I honestly thought that his speech last night set the tone for the Oscars. I thought the Golden Globes were so embarrassing because every winner got up there and they were just so infantile in their behavior. I mean, we have to remember, at the end of the day, they're just winning a trophy. You just get a prize. I realize it's the Oscar and a lot of people aim for it, but it's not serious.
You know what I liked about him is that his mother, teen mother, talked about how she was pregnant with her second kid and his brother was there. So he gave a tribute to his mother who looked like she had him when she was about 12 because she looked pretty young herself. So I liked that part. But I don't like people saying we're all thinking about what's going on in the Ukraine because they're not. And they're not thinking about that. They're thinking about, am I going to win? Am I not going to win? Where's the party going to happen? You know, so I don't like that. Because maybe he's thinking about it, but I think he's probably in the minority.
You know, speaking, I just one last thing. You did mention, Marjorie and I were talking about political speeches at the awards shows, and it is true. Jane Fonda, after Clute, after she won the Academy Award for Clute, did decide not to do politics. In 1978, Vanessa Redgrave won the Oscar for her work in Julia, and she talks about, you refuse to be intimidated by a small bunch of Zionist hoodlums, the crowd boos, etc. And then the great moment is a little bit later in the same night, screenwriter and Oscar presenter Patty Chayefsky responds to Vanessa Redgrave. Listen to what Chayefsky had to say.
I would like to suggest to Ms. Redgrave that her winning an Academy Award is not a pivotal moment in history. Does not require a proclamation, and a simple thank you would have sufficed.
I have to say, I was a pretty good,
shot across the bow before Vanessa Redgrave.
And I think she's still tainted by that, by the way.
I think that's true.
Is.
So, what state? What, as I said in the introduction to you getting here, Jared, what has a shelf life? What are moments or awards or what are things that are going to stay with you from last night, maybe from the whole season?
Well, I think that the 12 Years a Slave win is the moment from last night. I think actually going in, you could predict. I don't think any of the big Oscar winners were in terms of the category, the acting categories. None of those were a surprise. I think all of those were pretty much preordained going in. But the trajectory that Gravity had throughout the night, you sort of thought that they were going to win, especially after winning Best Director, that they would win Best Picture. But then at the last moment, for 12 Years a Slave to win and to have Steve McQueen, the director up there, who unfortunately did not win Best Director, and I'm not necessarily sure that's an oversight.
But he was the first black director to win Best Picture, right?
To have the Best Picture, absolutely. To have that moment there, I mean, we have come a long way. And it's so sad to say that in 85 years, that this is the first time that it's happened to have an African-American director have the Best Picture film, and we still have conversations about the black actors who were nominated. It still seems that we're sort of in a throwback time.
Okay, Jared, what I'm going to do for you is, you know, I'm a master of imitation. You know that. I'm going to do an imitation of one of the people, I won't say if it's a man or woman, who was nominated for Best Actor or Actress, and you have to tell me who the person is because I just saw the movie yesterday. This is the performance. Who is that?
There were no pornos.
Who is
nominated?
It was not intended to be an orgasmic.
You're talking about Sandra Bullock.
It was the worst. The fact that Sandra Bullock was nominated, and it's all she did for 91 minutes. I mean, it was unbelievable.
He thinks that's a terrible movie. I think first of all, you have to see it in the big screen.
I was dying to see it
in a 3D movie. We can get the full effect of when she was swinging around there in space.
There were no porn movies. Jared.
He thought it was When Harry Met Sally. I thought that's what you were talking about for a minute. minute there, Jim. But I liked Gravity. It ended rather abruptly, and I wish George Clooney had not been killed off in the first couple of seconds.
I guess you can tell people
Whoops.
Now.
Yep.
Yeah, that's right. It's a little late in the season.
It's early in the movie. He disappears.
And, you know, where's Matthew McConaughey? We were trying to figure out how to pronounce his name properly. The guy is brilliant. I mean, he is so... And I am a true detective obsessed, as most of the newsroom is. Where has this guy been? Has he just been a little
been
bit under the radar?
Pretty Boy movies,
he
right?
He's one of the finest actors I've seen in my lifetime.
He had a revelation. I think that's the other story. First of all, you have somebody like Lupita Nyong'o who comes out of nowhere and wins. Great story. Jared Leto comes back out of nowhere, wins. The same with Matthew McConaughey. He had a revelation. He realized, I am not fulfilling myself. And you sort of got this in his speech last night when he said that he just wants to be a better person, a better actor all of the time. And he realized that doing all of these romantic comedies was not getting him to where he wanted to be. Sure, he made all the money and he had the fame, but he was never really into that anyway because he was always sort of detached, always going back to Texas. And I think that he just, and he's talked about this, that he had a moment where he realized that the only way I'm going to fulfill myself and the dreams of my family and be the person that I want to be is if I start taking on projects that really matter to me. And that's why he found a project like the Dallas Buyers Club where he just had to fight. I had mentioned it was turned down by studios and had rejections over 100 times.
I didn't know that. Is that so?
Absolutely. It's so hard to make pictures like that. And Los Angeles Times has written about this today. Still, I mean, we just talked about African-Americans, but Hollywood doesn't want to deal with gay. They don't want to deal with AIDS. The Normal Heart, that great play, is about to be produced by HBO because no studio would touch it. There hasn't been another Philadelphia starring Tom Hanks in forever. Brokeback Mountain, I think, was an exception. So it's almost impossible to get stories like Dallas Buyers Club made. And
especially
then to have somebody like Matthew McConaughey do it, you know, who's supposed to be your stalwart, strong, typical romantic a comedy straight man,
yeah,
that's significant.
So you don't think he was going to get to the Oscar stage with his Sarah Jessica Parker movies about a boy who won't grow up and commit?
It would have been a long road.
Yeah,
so Cate Blanchett, who we barely mentioned, won Best Actress, and I am told, even though I cannot tell a lie, I was asleep at this point, she thanked Woody Allen. I assume that was the name no one would, and he didn't win Best Screenwriter.
Twice.
She thanked Woody. What, were you surprised by that?
No, because I'm trying to pull up my notes here, because she thanked him in a sort of a weird way. She thanked him only for casting her and nothing else. Thank you, Woody Allen, for casting me.
Not for his brilliant direction? Or
No. And I've watched the way that she's talked about him. She said in that 60 Minutes piece not too long ago that he told her first day of shooting that she was awful. I mean, can you imagine turning to Cate Blanchett, who is a great actor, who's been running the great Sydney Theatre Company, who has already won an Oscar for The Aviator, telling her she's terrible? I mean, what kind of director is that? It makes you wonder what kind of person he is, because I always talk about how he married his daughter wife, so I'm not a big fan anyway. But I thought she was careful last night.
You know what's interesting, and I think this is a trend, and you will tell me whether I'm right or wrong. The path back and forth from television to movies, it used to be seen, well, if you're a movie star, you don't lower yourself to do television. And if you're a television star, your hope is Kevin Spacey came out last night to present an award. And for those who are House of Cards addicted, which some of us are, here are the first words that were uttered by the 2-time Academy Award winner. Here is Spacey.
And I sing because it's so nice to be out of Washington and here with all my Hollywood friends.
He spoke right after Darlene Love had won. She and her colleagues had won for 20 Feet from Stardom, and Darlene Love sang, which was totally beautiful. But it's not seen as a step down so much anymore to be a television actor in addition to being a brilliant screen actor, correct?
No, because what's happening with projects like Breaking Bad and House of Cards
and anything
that you see on any of these cable stations or now Amazon and Netflix is you see fully realized movies. You see these arcs that actors can have over 12 hours. And so it's not episodic television where they're scrambling to come up with something as a typical ABC primetime show, for example, where they're scrambling to come up with 22 different stories that hopefully will be cohesive in the end. Here you have these wonderful, amazing narrative arcs that I think that ground is broken with The Sopranos, and that made it okay to come in and do for actors in film to do television.
You know, we don't have that much time left, but I want to know what you think, Jared Bowen. Kim Novak came out with Matthew McConaughey to accept an award. She's in her 80s. She looked like she was totally out of it, and I kept wondering, why was she there? She had difficulty talking. She had difficulty reading. What was that about?
It was part of the theme about heroes and heroines in the movies. And, of course, going back to her Hitchcock days in Vertigo, that's why they wanted her. She was also a coup in advance because she hadn't been seen in public for a really long time. And so that's why they got her. But that was it was difficult to watch,
wasn't
it? Oh,
it was very difficult to watch. And McConaughey was very gracious to her, too. I mean, because it was...
Put his arm around her, was helping her.
Yes, it was an awkward moment, and he was very good to her. But I felt so bad.
Now, Jared Bone, if you were me, would you talk to you more, or would you thank listeners who've contributed since this morning? Which would you do?
It's all about the listeners, Jim.
Exactly. So, Jared, it's great to see you. Jared Bone, we want to thank Katie in Pocasset, Mark in Brookline, Mary in Portsmouth, Rhode Island, Lily in Webster, Thomas in Lexington, Elaine in Narragansett, Rhode Island, everybody else who's pitched in. If you haven't, there is still time to support the programs you love here at GBH, including, and some might say especially, Jim and Marjorie, 888-897-9424, or just go online at WGBHnews.org. And we really, really appreciate your giving.
Yes, we absolutely do. Please tune in again tomorrow for Open Mic with Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane. And Globe reporter Neil Swidey also joins us to talk about the life and death story of cleaning up Boston Harbor. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, and John Parker are our production team. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
He's Jared Bowen. Thanks so much for being here.